A recent poll indicated that more than 70% of Americans believe the president was killed as a result of a conspiracy and that officialdom concealed the truth of what really happened. In the 1980s, Anthony Summers wrote his book Not in Your Lifetime, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He has now reworked his originally published book, updating the work with new information, interviews, and access to thousands of previously unavailable documents. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Anthony Summers to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Hello.
Give us a sense of what brought you to the subject in the first time, of taking a look at this day and this tragic event.
Well, oddly enough, I stayed away from it as a reporter in the first place. I was at Oxford University when it happened. Everyone's got a story, as you know, if they're old enough, about what they were doing on the day. I was working in a pub and I got a call because I'd been moonlighting, doing a bit of student journalism in the evening, and I'd made contact with a big television program, and the big boss himself rang me and said, "We're chartering a plane to go to Texas," which was extraordinary in 1963, and he said, "Can you join the team?" And what a dream assignment, if it wasn't such a tragedy. But then his assistant rang back a few minutes later to say that they'd found somebody more experienced than me. So I never covered that story, and I stayed away from it like the plague, because the sillier conspiracy theories began to pop up, and there was district attorney Jim Garrison had his circus of an investigation in New Orleans. And I thought it was a story in which journalistic reputations sunk without trace. But then, when the House Assassinations Committee in 1979 came up with a complete reversal of the Warren Commission lone assassin conclusion, and said that there had been a conspiracy, albeit a rather unsatisfactory verdict, probable conspiracy, I got interested, and I did a documentary for the BBC and had so much more material than one could put in a television program hour that I then put together a book, and to my amazement, the book did succeed with the people like the Boston Globe that you kindly mentioned that matter. And I have not worked on the case ever since, I hasten to say, but I've returned to it, and I've returned to it now because it seems the right time at the 50th anniversary to set down as much, I like to think, for the sensible citizen with an open mind as one can.
When you talk of that open mind and that sensible citizen with an open mind, how many of those people out there do you think there are, in the sense of this is a story that has been percolating and new generations coming into it, of course, for 50 years, and a lot of opinions have been cemented in many ways?
I think that some have been cemented, but you rightly said that a majority of the American people have the notion that there was a conspiracy. Now, there's a danger here because, you know, it, in a way, it's awful, but the Kennedy assassination has, in a way, become a sort of entertainment, or perhaps one should say infotainment. But nevertheless, I find that very young people, my son, for example, is in his late 20s, and not just because his father has written this book, it's clear that he and others of his generation, that the assassination resonates with them. It means something. And why does it resonate? I think it's because no other death of a single individual, and a young individual, embodying the hopes of a new generation, so traumatized an era. And it stays with us because John F. Kennedy was killed during the Cold War at a time of enormous nuclear tension about the possibility of nuclear conflict, in which he'd stepped in and essentially saved the world from nuclear conflict in 1962. And perhaps above all, it ended the sense of cozy security of the earlier period and the beginning of doubt in those who legislate and the authorities that run our lives. This period of doubt would, of course, become even more so after Watergate and the events of the 70s, leading up to now. I think those are some of the reasons that we still care about it.
As you suggested a moment ago, there were millions of pages of assassination records that were finally made public in the late 1990s, and yet the CIA is withholding more than 1,000 documents until 2017. And the question that you ask is, why hold these records back if, as we were told a half century ago, Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin?
Yes, they are indeed withholding 1,171 documents, and the reason they've given for withholding them is that they are national security classified. That's the quote. This is interesting. Why did I call my book Not in Your Lifetime? I called it that because when Chief Justice Warren, who of course headed the original investigation, the Warren Commission, when he was asked whether all the documents of his investigation would be released, he said, well, yes, most of them. And then he paused and said, but there may be some matters that involve security, and they won't be released in your lifetime. But still, as you say, one has to ask why effectively that lifetime has passed. It's 50 years on. Why is it that documents still have to be retained on the basis of national security?
So with the documents that came out in the late 1990s and with your book, what were you able to find out and conclude definitively, you believe, about the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was part of a conspiracy?
Well, you know, I avoid the definitive is the word the Boston Globe used. It's very kind of them, but I don't think any of us who are in the nonfiction business or are serious journalists can say that the case is solved. Of course it's not. And I think the honest way to report this case is to say that we still don't know the answer. There are some doubts as to whether the alleged assassin, Oswald, did in fact fire that day. Of course, he claimed, and you might say he would, wouldn't he, that he had been a patsy, that he'd been in some way set up. On the other hand, there are indications that we couldn't deal with in a brief radio interview that he was, at the end, in the weeks before the assassination, wittingly or unwittingly being used by some part of U.S. intelligence in the black propaganda war against Fidel Castro's Cuba. And if one takes that on board, and the documents do indicate that, they also indicate that the Central Intelligence Agency certainly has concealed information about what he was up to and their relationship with his visit to Oswald's visit to Mexico City just 6 weeks before the assassination. There's something being concealed there, and I suspect that that's what the retention of the 1,000 documents by the CIA is about. On the other hand, we have some quite persuasive evidence that the leaders of organized crime, which to the layman is the U.S. Mafia, and that the anti-Castro movement, some of the Cuban exiles, may have been behind the assassination. I say that carefully. I'm not stating that that is what happened, but both had motive. Oswald had no motive. Oswald was known for saying he rather liked the president. And for a murder, one usually needs means and opportunity and motive. He didn't have a motive. The mob, on the other hand, organized crime, were being pursued by the Kennedy administration as never before in the history of the U.S. Mafia. Many were being deported from the United States back to Sicily and Italy. They also had lost their empire of casinos and hotels and so on, which at the time was even more important to organized crime than Las Vegas. The anti-Castro exiles, for their part, of course, had motive to get rid of Fidel Castro, and some of them were loathed President Kennedy. They thought that he'd betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs. He'd done a deal that they thought was shameful in some way over the missile crisis in 1962, and that he betrayed them further by clamping down on their activities, armed raids and so on, during 1963. And indeed, there are papers and some tapes, audio tapes and so on, suggesting that they may have been wanting to kill him. And I know this is a very long answer, but the what woke me up and woke up the former chief counsel of the Assassinations Committee, Robert Blakey, was an interview we did, and I've written about this in the last brand new part of the book. We did an interview in 2007 with an old Cuban exile in his 80s who said that he wanted to get something off his chest before he died. And that something essentially provided the first ever plausible identification, and you can hear me choosing my words very carefully here, the first ever plausible identification of a man, another Cuban exile, who may have been a gunman in Dealey Plaza in 1963 and admitted it, said that he had done it, said in his words that he had had participación, that he'd had participation in the murder in Dallas.
In addition to Lee Harvey Oswald.
No, he didn't say that. What he literally said was that before he himself died on a raid against Castro's Cuba,
right,
was that he had had participation in the assassination.
But my question...
I do not know. Yeah, I don't know what role Lee Harvey Oswald played.
That is still a question mark of how he fits into this story, because you write in the book about the phone calls that he received from Louisiana just days before the assassination. So the shot that would have killed the president, was that a shot that was fired by this man that you mentioned, or by Lee Harvey Oswald?
I said earlier that the most honest thing that a nonfiction author or a good reporter can say is that one does not know. What we do know, it was the last shot that killed President Kennedy, the shot that essentially tore off the one side of his head. And that shot, according to the Assassinations Committee, it seems, not according to the Assassinations Committee, but according to many theorists, was a shot that came from the right front rather than from behind where Oswald was. So the suspicion would be that he was killed by a gunman shooting from the right front, and I hate to use the word, but from that famous grassy knoll, that infamous, perhaps, grassy knoll that we've heard about all these years. You know, I sometimes think, as I've been saying today, that this is now treated as entertainment, and one suddenly realizes with a jerk that it really isn't and wasn't ever entertainment. Jacqueline Kennedy gave an interview to Life magazine just a week after her husband had been killed. And Life magazine thought the interview was too raw to use, that the public couldn't take that kind of thing in those days. But we have it now. It was suppressed for years, but we have it now. And she said, you know, when he was shot, he had such a wonderful expression on his face. Then he looked puzzled. He had his hand out. I could see a piece of his skull coming off. It was flesh-colored, not white. He was holding out his hand, and I could see this perfectly clean piece detaching itself from his head. And then she went on to say that on the way to the hospital, because they did, although they were only going through the motions by that time, there was no way to bring him back, but on the way to the hospital, she kept saying, I love you, Jack. And I kept saying, Jack, Jack. I kept bending over him saying, Jack, can you hear me? I love you, Jack. I kept holding the top of his head down, trying to keep the... And she couldn't finish the sentence. And you can understand why.
In the book, you do not claim that the CIA was involved in the assassination, but you do bring information showing that a senior agency officer, David Phillips, spread disinformation about his own activity and on Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination right up until his death.
Yes, Phillips did do that, and I don't know what it means. I mean, there are those out there in the very, very living community of people who dig into this case all the time who would suggest that the CIA's David Phillips, whom I met and who eventually rose to a very high rank in the CIA, was involved in the assassination. I don't think we have that information. I think that we do have indications that he knew something about the way in which Oswald, as I put it earlier, with his knowledge or without his knowledge, was being manipulated before the assassination in matters that I think probably were nothing to do with the assassination, and that what happened afterwards, as soon as the bullets hit and Oswald had been arrested, I think it possible, although we do not know, that the relevant people at the CIA ran for cover to conceal the fact that they'd had anything to do with this young man. And as often in life, if you cover up at all, you end up with the suspicion that you're covering up something much more sinister than you are. And that may be the answer to the riddle.
When it comes to the questions that still remain in your mind, as you say, you don't know anything definitively, but top amongst the questions that you still have that you think need answering for you to come to a definitive conclusion, they include what?
Well, they include especially to untie the knots that Oswald's visit to Mexico City in the weeks before the assassination are wrapped up in, to untie the knots, to explain just exactly what was going on. I have a speculation, and this is the only speculation, I think, in the whole book, to explain the fact that when he'd previously been a defector to the Soviet Union, who had said when he went to the Soviet Union, in the American embassy, I'm going to give everything I've learned working on the U-2 spy plane base in Japan, rather think the drones of today. Just a few years ago, if an American defector had said that he was going to give an enemy all the secrets about the drone aircraft, you would think that at a time when even tourists were questioned on their return from the Soviet Union, that Lee Harvey Oswald, my goodness, when he did return back to the United States, that before he returned to civilian life, you would think that he would have been severely interrogated and maybe put on trial as a traitor to his country. But that didn't happen. The CIA has always said they didn't question him. Well, some documents have emerged suggesting that they may have done. And my one speculation in the book is what would have happened at that session. They might have said to him, look, pal, you're going to jail for a long period of time, or you'll be put on trial for treason. Or they might have said to him, look, you could go to jail, or we may have a use for you at some point. Continue to apparently have a left-wing stance, a leftist stance, and we may be able to put you to use at some time. That might have happened. And so one needs to see the actual documentation about what happened when Oswald returned from Russia. There's not much more to learn now. You know, we've been talking for years and years. Americans have been talking about which way did the bullets come from? Did a bullet come from in front of him? Which bullets came from behind him? We're not going to get anywhere with any of that now. The autopsy was badly botched. That's accepted by the most sober observers. What we might get somewhere by getting full access to the material on the intelligence aspects of the affair.
Being a British journalist, do you feel that you bring a different background to the story? And not only in this story, but the last time you were with us was on your book about 9/11.
Yes. I won't hold it against you, but I am in fact Irish and not British, in spite of the accent. And I think that gives me even more ability to answer your question. I think, on the one hand, it gives one a distance from it. I'm not an American, and it's good not to be too closely involved with a story in order to investigate it. It's certainly, one shouldn't be involved at an emotional level. On the other hand, the Kennedys were famously of Irish origin. They came from a homestead just 40 or 50 miles from where I live in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a special feeling about the Kennedys here. Kennedy had been here just months before he died, and he'd said, I'm coming back in the springtime. And when I was in my middle years, certainly Kennedy's picture was next to that of the current Pope in thousands of homes across the country, and that gives it an immediacy. I don't think I've let it affect my journalism, though.
Well, the name of the book is Not in Your Lifetime, the defining book on the JFK assassination, 50 years on, weighing the evidence, and it is published by Open Road Media. Anthony Summers, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Anthony Summers is the author of the book Not in Your Lifetime, published by Open Road Media. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.